And there was a window open on the top floor, and two beautiful ladies were looking out, waving at each helicopter that came in. And it was Joan Baez and Judy Collins. I said, I think this is going to be a good one. He doesn't know about this yet. And this week or next week, I'm going to be talking to him and saying, surprise, surprise, surprise. Remember 1986?
So I know before Joe Satriani. That's fantastic. Hello and welcome to episode 28 of Vintage Rock Pod, the ultimate twice-weekly classic rock podcast that proudly claims that my music is better than yours. I'm Paul Stevenson, thanks as always for hitting play. Now on this week's show, we've got another Rock and Roll Hall of Famer, our seventh of the series so far, and this guest was inducted way back in 1993. He's the drummer with a band that formed as teenagers. They took a while to break through, but when they did, they ended up releasing seven incredible albums in just 4 years between 1968 and 1972. With that came nine top 10 singles in the US and a number one single here in the UK as well. They've sold around 30 million records in the US alone, and their compilation, Chronicle, the 20 Greatest Hits, has spent over 500 weeks on the Billboard 200 album chart since it was released back in 1976. It's incredible. I am, of course, talking about the band Creedence Clearwater Revival, and today's guest is the drummer Doug Cosmo Clifford, whose name is on their biggest selling studio album, Cosmo's Factory. Now, I spoke to Doug a couple of weeks ago, a few days before his 76th birthday, in fact. He was in great form despite the onset of Parkinson's disease, which has curtailed any touring plans for the future. Now, we caught up to chat about some music of his featuring people like Joe Satriani and Stu Wright from the Greg Kinn Band that's now getting a release 35 years after it was originally recorded. We, of course, chat a little bit about his Creedence days and Woodstock as well. So here we go. Please enjoy my chat with Doug Cosmo Clifford. I'm delighted to welcome to Vintage Rock Pod a man who's part of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, a man who is part of one of the biggest groups of all time as well. They've sold millions and millions and millions upon millions of records. Welcome to Vintage Rock Pod, the man himself, Doug Cosmo Clifford from Creedence Clearwater Revival. Hi, Doug.
Hi, Paul. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you very much for joining me. You've got an exciting new album coming out, aren't you, in June. You've sent me the songs across and they all sound fantastic. Now, tell me a little bit about this album, because you brought one out last year, didn't you? Magic Window. And that was a collection of songs that was in your vault that had been hidden away for 35 years. And this is from that same vault, isn't it?
Yes, it is. And there are more gems in there as well. But this was a project called Clifford Wright. I would be the Clifford part. Steve Wright from Greg Kinn is the Wright part. Unfortunately, he passed away in 2017, and I'm carrying the music that we wrote and that I produced in this album. And when we recorded this, now you have to understand, this was recorded in 1986, so several sessions with different people on the one you're listening to. The guitarists, there are three, Joe Satriani, Greg Douglas from Steve Miller Band, and Jimmy Lyon from many bands. I believe he is another Bay Area boy. These are all San Francisco Bay Area musicians, but we're from on the East Bay. That's where Creedence came from. And that's the blue collar side, and not the psychedelic side. So it's a really cool rock and roll record. I think it's got a lot of energy in it and good players, and we had a good time making the record, and so I can't wait to share it with the world here in a couple of months.
Absolutely, I'm loving some of the rockier songs on there. Lost Pride, Fever, You're Gonna Love Again. Tell me about those ones.
Well, back in 1985, it was the Summer Olympics, I believe it was. And back then, America was taking bronze and not taking the gold medals because the Russians were. Mm-hmm. And the Russians were using drugs. And so the Lost Pride's Fever was about that. We were getting beat up, but they were doing it with performance-enhancing drugs. And that's what that song is about. But as art and history sort of meld together, here we are with a pandemic, and there's a lot of fever involved in that. And it's people are being completely stymied by this worldwide. It's affected all of our lives. You know, I go to the grocery store, and that's pretty much it. The good news is I have a nice studio in my house, and I can work. So you can just take that song and put it in the picture frame of today, and people would say, "Oh, you wrote that for the pandemic." Well, I didn't know it at the time. As long as it works.
Yes, yes, yeah, yeah. Little global crystal ball that you were looking in at the time. So in terms of the album itself, then, you mentioned the guitarist that you worked with, and incredible, they'd all worked with Greg Kinn and all these sorts of Eddie Money guys that you mentioned. I mean, Joe Satriani is obviously a legend as well when it comes to playing the guitar. I mean, what do you remember about the recording sessions you working with Joe and Greg and Jimmy?
Well, I remember a lot. You know, Joe was, this is before he started surfing with aliens. You know, he had not arrived quite yet. I mean, he was a very well-respected guitarist, certainly. We hadn't put that part of the band together. We had everybody else in place, committed to their spot. But we didn't have the guitar spot filled. So it was a combination of I needed a guitar track or a guitar player to play on four tracks of the 11. What I remember about it was that, you know, he's used to being the guy out front. Mm-hmm. He's not used to being in a secondary role as support for a lead vocalist. And so I found that out at the session. So he was playing a lot of notes in places where less is best. And so I, you know, had a little meeting. I said, "Joe, I know that you're just a terrific guitar player, and there are spots that you will be able to do that, like in the solo spots, but in the verses and chorus where there's a vocal going on, you need to support that. Sometimes you do that by playing in a hole or leaving something out of a hole, you know." So I wanted to be positive about it. Yeah. And I could see that he wasn't particularly loving that. But as the session went on, you know, well, you heard it, you know, he did a terrific job, as did all the guitar players, the other two as well. But Joe played on four of those songs. And when the session was all over, he had a big smile on his face. I said, "You did a terrific job." He says, "You know," he says, I enjoyed it. I really learned something today." Brilliant. And I went, "Wow, what a cool guy." And that goes to show you, you know, that he could have done an ego trip or whatever, but he actually learned something that he could put in his resume, and he didn't, as it turned out, he didn't have to, and he went to that place where he played a million notes per minute, and I of course enjoy and respect his talents. So I'm excited. He doesn't know about this yet, and in fact, this week or next week I'm going to be talking to him and saying, "Surprise, surprise, surprise." Remember 1986?
I love that. So I know before Joe Satriani. That's fantastic. In terms of this record, then, we were emailing backward and forward, and you said it was coming out in June. Have you got all the release, the distribution, everything like that sorted for it?
Well, we have not exact time. As I say, it's late June right now. What I'm trying to do is find also the right place to release it. Yeah. So I'm not competing against other releases from my own record company. And in this case, it'll be my record company, because the fellow that I made the deal with is a distributor, Sony Orchard. So it's the big guns will have Sony in there, and then he will come in and oversee what it's coming from my label, which will be Cliff Song Records. And so I'll be able to call the shots, basically. And I'm very excited about that. The Magic Window Project had everything but what a record company would do. I didn't have a record company, so I came out on a CD Baby, which is an independent. They don't have the close ties and the big guns that Sony Orchard has. So I'm very excited about that.
Absolutely exciting times. You mentioned Magic Window there. Let's touch on that, because as you said, well, as we said right at the start of the interview, it was part of this vault of material that you've got, and you've got plenty more to come. But this album, Magic Window, came out last year, didn't it? It came out, I think it was April last year.
Right when the pandemic hit.
Good timing, Cosmo. Good timing.
Who knew?
Exactly. In terms of Magic Window, then, it differs slightly from the Clifford Wright one in the fact that you were singing, weren't you, on the Magic Window songs?
Well, I'll tell you why. You know, we had a great singer in the Clifford Wright project, and it just didn't work. There were internal things, so I decided, well, I want a deal for sure. And so I put together Magic Window, where I was a singer-songwriter. And I co-wrote with different guys. This Clifford Wright material is just Steve Wright and me writing. The Magic Window is me writing some complete songs just by myself, and then writing with a few guys that I do writing with. And so that's how I did Magic Window. And it's the best singer-songwriter project I've had. And I really worked on the vocals. That was what was weak on my first solo album. And so I thought it came out pretty good. I'm very proud of it. I mean, it'll be re-released somewhere down the line, a couple of years from now, maybe. I've got a couple of other things in the vault that'll be coming out before that. But it's one of those amazing things that, you know, you find something 35 years old. And not only did you find it, but it plays, and we were able to, you know, take it from analog and get it to digital so we could preserve it, because we didn't know how long that tape would last being 35 years old. And I get to do it on my own label. So it's a kind of a songwriter, record company, publishing deal, because all the songs I'm the writer or co-writer on. So it's my writing. That's pretty cool. And, That's my future. I've retired from playing on the road. I've got Parkinson's disease, and so it's starting to come along. Stu, I told Stu when we had a project called Creedence Clearwater Revisited, and where we played only Creedence songs. Stu Cook, the bass player, of course, from Creedence Clearwater Revival, and we had a 5-year plan, and it ended up being 25 years. So we played a lot. I've been a road dog for 25 years, and physically I'm beat up. And so I told Stewie, I says, well, I guess we're going to have to learn a new song for the set. And he said, what are you talking about? I said, well, we've got to learn Shake, Rattle, and Roll. Shake. My hands are shaking now. So anyway, you got to keep your sense of humor about things like that. It's something that happened, and I've been blessed in my life and my career, and I've been with my wife 53 years. Wow. Married, and then 6 years going steady. Before that, we were high school sweethearts. So life has been very good to me. I've had two careers, highly successful careers. The first one was Revival, and then the second one was Revisited. Now I get to have my own record label and put songs out that I've written, and wow, it's pretty, you know. And that's something about dreams. I believe in them because I've been in the middle of them, and bigger, and they've come out bigger than the dream itself was imagined. But here's the real nitty gritty of it for all you dreamers. If you have a dream and you have to be totally committed to it, you have to be totally passionate about it, you have to give 110% of what you have in your heart and in your head to make it work. You can sit around and dream and wait for the dream to come and sit in your lap and say, okay, now you're a rock star. It ain't gonna happen. You gotta make it happen.
Absolutely.
That's my story, and I'm sticking with it.
That's your words of wisdom for us. Seeing as we've got you on the line, it'd be nice just to talk quickly about Creedence, if you don't mind, Cosmo. Like I said at the start, it was one of the biggest groups in the world at the time, wasn't it? The end of the 60s, the early 70s. I mean, the height of the fame, you guys were as big as anybody could be, and it was just incredible.
Well, you know, our when we started the band, we were 13 years of age, and our sort of credo or our call to the winds that blow was someday we want to have our records played on the radio. That was what we were shooting for. Well, they've been playing them for 53 years. We were only 13, so that was an extra 40 years, you know.
Absolutely. And just because you're the first person I've spoken to that actually played at the legendary Woodstock. I mean, I know there was slight issues. You didn't get on till after midnight and things like that. But what are your memories of that incredible event?
Well, it was crazy because first and foremost, the logistics were completely blown out of the you know, we're flying in, and we flew an all-night flight because we were doing a television show. They had two different unions, and they hated each other, and they had breaks and dinners and lunches at different times. So when one stopped, the other one had to stop, whatever it was that they did. And it was maddening, and they had a lot of technical problems. And so it got down to the last take. We said, we got a gig we have to go to. And this is the last flight. We're going to fly all night, which we're not thrilled about. But if you don't get it this time, you don't get it. And also on that, it was Andy Williams. And also on that show was Ray Charles. Uh-huh. And to add a little frosting on the cake, it was a reunion of Ray Charles and the Ray Letts, and they hadn't seen each other or worked together in years. And it was really, you know, they were crying and hugging each other, and to meet, see one of your idols there and be able to listen to him rehearse. I mean, I thought I had a cold by the time that was over, because I had so many chills just listening to Ray and seeing the wonderful reunion of a group. And it was really cool. But anyway, we got the take, but right in the middle of it, there was a big feedback, and it wasn't us. It came from one of the unions, but it's, if you ever see the reruns of the Andy Williams show, you'll hear it or see it. John rolled his eyes. And then we ran down and got in the limo and went to the airport and then flew all night. So when we get to where we're going, we were supposed to go a certain way, and they said, well, that's all different now. We're going to have to get you fly into a smaller airport that's closer because we can't use the roads. What do you mean? It's not raining or anything. They said, no, but there are hundreds of thousands of people that have come to this thing. And there was a traffic jam, so they just left their cars in the street where they were, and they walked in. And we said, "You can't be serious!" Said, oh yeah, there's 500,000 people here, and now we're going. Oh, okay, there is no way there's going to be 500,000 people. Make a long story short, they flew us in. A two-man helicopter turned into a three-man helicopter. And I was sitting, John was sitting in the middle. The pilot was in the pilot seat, of course. And I'm sitting on the I've got my leg out the door, and I'm and it's one of those bubble tops that looks like a dragonfly. And I'm holding the door because otherwise it'll be flapping in the wind and beating my leg. And so my right leg was out of the helicopter on the skid. didn't have wheels, so it's on the skid. I'm with my right leg. I'm holding the door semi-shut, my legs in there. And then I'm holding on to John's safety belt, and my left cheek is on his seat. We're showing the seat. So we're flying in, and it was a perfect time to come in and see this wonderful, magnificent sight, because the sun was going down. And, you know, when sun goes down, the sun rays get more direct and things seem brighter and more colorful. And as we came up over this little rise, and there they were. And I said, it's a patchwork quilt of humanity. I remember saying that. I said, I'll remember that for the rest of my life. And I said, at least 450,000 people here. It's unbelievable. And so the helicopter was landing next to a three-story building, and there was a window open on the top floor, and two beautiful ladies were looking out, waving at each helicopter that came in. And it was Joan Baez and Judy Collins. I said, I think this is going to be a good one. Then it became a kind of a nightmare, because we were supposed to headline. I don't know how our equipment got in to this day. I don't know how it happened, how they even were able to hook up with us. We had a show to do, and that was, you know, the focus. We weren't going to go running out and take drugs and be shuck our responsibilities just because other guys were doing it. We were there to play a show, and there were a lot of problems about that. Rain, electronics, people not going on because of the rain. Problems with going over their time, a lot of time limit. So we didn't, the headliner got on stage Sunday morning at about 1 or 2 in the morning. And I thought we played all right, considering the situation. And John said we didn't play well and wouldn't allow us to be in the movie or on the record. And so nobody knew that we were there. And quite honestly, I think if we weren't there, there wouldn't have been, it wouldn't have happened. And I'll explain that. All the big bands who had real managers were sitting on the sidelines waiting for somebody credible. And at that time, we were number one in the world in record sales, and we were number one concert draw in 69 and 70. So we're number one in the world. And so they're waiting for somebody to go in. All the big guys, you know, the Who and this and that, Jimi Hendrix and all of them. So when we said, okay, we'll do it, they all jumped in. Now, what happens if we say, "Nah, you guys don't have enough experience. We're gonna pass." I don't think it would have happened.
Wow.
I honestly don't. So there's something to throw in there—a little historical theory, if you will. Now, you know, John's embraced the whole thing. He even has a Volkswagen bus. It's too neat a paint job. It doesn't look like the real thing. But anyway, he's embraced it, and which is good. But we'll never be in the movie, and most people will never know that we were there. But historically, that's the big one, and there'll never be another one because of. And then I'll tell you what: if there would have been beer there instead of weed, I think there would have been a lot more violence. There would have been violence. There was none. But people just got stoned and said the hell with the rain and played in the mud like kids and shared whatever they had, because there was certainly not enough food or drink or toilets for that many people. I mean, they were hoping to have 50,000 people there. And so they had 10% of what they needed in terms of
facilities and things,
basic necessities. for the public at large. A lot of people peed on trees, I can tell you that.
Absolutely. That's incredible stories. I mean, if you'd have said no, then the biggest concert in history might not have happened. That's fascinating stuff.
Yeah.
Well, it's been an absolute pleasure to chat with you, Cosmo. I've enjoyed every minute of it. I love hearing your stories. And we wish you all the best of luck with the Clifford Wright material that comes out in the future. And it'd be great to catch up with you again. We hope it all goes well for you.
Thanks, Paul.
The wonderful Doug Cosmo Clifford there. As was said, Creedence Clearwater Revival were one of the biggest bands in the world during those late 60s, early 70s years, era-defining in many ways, made up of Cosmo on the drums, Stu Cook on the bass, John Fogerty was the lead singer, lead guitarist and primary songwriter in the band, and his older brother Tom Fogerty was the rhythm guitarist. Now, the roots of the band go back to 1959, and various name changes later, they settled on Creedence Clearwater Revival in around 1967, which led to worldwide fame. But the story of the band is not a fairy tale one, though, sadly. Many disagreements and recriminations led to the band split after four chart-topping years in 1972, a year after Tom Fogerty had left the band himself. The full four-piece never properly patched things up, and Tom sadly passed away before they were inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Now, as you heard him say in the interview, Cosmo and Stu played and toured for many years as well, as Creedence Clearwater Revisited, playing the songs of the band. Now, for a band with such a short span in terms of recording years, the music that John wrote and they performed and released was incredible. Seven albums released in 4 years, with all but one being certified platinum in the US. They have a catalogue of songs full of anthems and classics, which makes today's top five list as hard as any I've had to do on the show so far. Now, whittling the tracks down, initially I got them to about 12. I had to make some tough calls to get them into a top 5, and I honestly feel so bad leaving out some of the tracks that I have, because I know if you ask me again in a month or so's time, the list could well be different again. But for now, here's my favourite tracks of theirs. This is the top 5 Creedence Clearwater Revival songs according to Vintage Rock Pod. At 5 is a song that seems synonymous with Ike and Tina Turner these days, but the original is superb. From their second album, Bayou Country, it went top 10 all over the world in 1969. Rolling on the River, indeed. And number 5 is Proud Mary. Number 4 is their biggest hit in the UK, went to number 1 and is taken from their album Green River. It's full of weather imagery with earthquakes, lightning, hurricanes and rivers overflowing. And number 4 is Bad Moon Rising. My number 3 is a funky little number with a big sing-along chorus. It sounds almost like an autobiographical tune with the four boys on the corner trying to bring you up. It's the opening track on the album Willie and the Poor Boys. And number 3 for me is Down on the Corner. And number 2 is a track I've always loved, one of their later singles from 1971 off their 6th album Pendulum. It's an acoustic guitar number with a sad, somber vibe, but again a killer chorus. Some say it's about the Vietnam War, some speculate it's about the end of 60s idealism. John Fogerty has been quoted as saying it's about the rising tensions in the band that led to his brother leaving. Either way, it made for a great song. And number 2 for me is Have You Ever Seen the Rain? If there was any dubiety about the subject matter for number 2, this certainly isn't about my number 1 track. It's about class division and Vietnam, and the solidarity with soldiers fighting over there. This quickly became an anti-war anthem. It's an upbeat, rocky number which brilliantly showcases the gravelly, raw vocals of John so well. From the Willie and the Poor Boys album, the number 1 Creedence Clearwater Revival song, according to the Vintage Rock Pod, has to be the iconic Fortunate Son. And I know you're going to be saying, how could he leave out Up Around the Bend or Born on the Bayou or Who'll Stop the Rain or Looking Out My Back Door? Again, Commotion and Ramble Tamble were so close for me as well into the top 5, but there we have it. As always, I'd love to hear your thoughts on the list. Where do you agree? Where do you disagree? Drop me an email, vintagerockpod@gmail.com, or you can message me on the socials as well. Just search for Vintage Rock Pod on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram and YouTube, and give us a like or a follow on all those sites as well. And you can sign up to become a VRP VIP too. You can receive a once a week newsletter where you find out first about future guests. You get your chance as well to put a question to them, and lots of other interesting things that I don't always get time to share on here with you. Just go to vintagerockpod.com, fill in the form on that first page. It's free, doesn't cost you anything, and I'm not going to be passing on your data, and you'll only ever get one email a week, I can promise you that. So there you go, sign up to become a VRP VIP today, vintagerockpod.com. Also, don't forget, Vintage Rock Pod Side 2 is going to be out every Friday. It's a magazine-style show with various different guests full of classic rock content for you. Now, last week's Side 2, had a UK rock festival organiser talking about how they're arranging this year's festival with the COVID issues and getting bands booked and all that sort of stuff. There was also an American concert fan talking about his concert experiences and the tickets he's bought for the first time in over a year. And we also got the latest classic rock news from author and music journalist with Record Collector magazine and Universal Music, Tim Peacock. So loads going on in there. If you've not heard that one, go back and have a listen. And on next week's Vintage Rock Pod Classic Rock Stories Monday episode, I'm going to have another guy who played at Woodstock. Yes, you heard that right. A second guest who played at Woodstock, the legendary festival. Find out more about that next Monday. Until then, though, and the next episode, which comes out on Friday, which is Side 2, remember, if you come across anyone who isn't a fan of rock, just tell them, my music is better than yours. Take care.